Hi, my name is Lauren Templeton, and you are listening to Investing the Templeton Way. This podcast is for anyone interested in learning more about investing. In this podcast, I will be interviewing some of the greatest minds from the investment community and exploring topics ranging from international markets to behavioral finance. To learn more, please visit us at investingthetempletonway.com. The information presented in this podcast or available on the website is not intended as and shall not be construed as financial advice. This podcast is produced for entertainment value. Investing is inherently risky, and I encourage you to seek financial advice from a professional who is aware of the facts and circumstances of your individual situation. Thanks for listening.
Let me start by welcoming everyone to the Investing the Templeton Way podcast, where we interview the most brilliant thinkers in the field of finance. And Scott and I are so happy to welcome today's guest. I have waited forever to have Arnold Vandenberg on the show. And my intro to Arnold is straight off of his website because I found that it was the best intro that I could come up with. But Arnold began his career in investments in 1968 as the U.S. stock market was experiencing its worst decline since the Great Depression. Arnold spent these difficult years studying Wall Street, the market, and various investment philosophies. And he ultimately concluded that the managers who used a value-based investment strategy both protected their clients' capital better and provided more consistent investment results than managers using other investment strategies. In September of 1974, Arnold started his own investment advisory business, Century Management, and uses a value investing approach. From humble beginnings, Arnold Vandenberg, a Holocaust survivor, learned at an early age what it means to work hard, to sacrifice, and to help others. It is his spirit of helping that has shaped the way he has lived his life and runs his business. So welcome, Arnold Vandenberg.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here today. And so we can get started.
Yes, I believe I initially met you at, we were just discussing this, at a Fairfax meeting. We were sitting next to each other. It might have been Fairfax Africa, if my memory recalls. And after meeting you, I was discussing with a So I have been really just interested in you since that moment. I've read so much about you. Please start by telling the audience a little bit about your background, your experience of being a Holocaust survivor, and then ultimately what led you to a career in investing.
Okay, well, I guess I could start off by saying I was born in Amsterdam, Holland. We lived on the same street as Anne Frank. Most of you have probably heard about the story about Anne Frank. She lived at the 267 block and the Prinsengracht, and we lived at 823 Prinsengracht, so it wasn't too far away. And when the war started, my mom was born in Poland, my dad was born in Germany, and they went to escape the Nazis in 33. They were very early. My dad was a student of history, so he saw this coming, and he migrated to Holland, and he married my mom in Germany before they left. So they did very well. They started a business. My mom was a fabulous businesswoman. And they started off on the end of a dirt road street, and they built it into a pretty good business as the war was going. But then as the war got going, things got worse and worse, and they knew that it would be dangerous to stay in Holland. So my dad suggested that to my mom that we move to South Africa, which would have been a very good move, but my mom didn't want to move because she had a family at that time. There were 39 members that died during the Holocaust, but she had her whole family there. They had a successful business, and it was just hard to get up and leave. And she didn't really believe that, you know, the things that happened were going to happen. They didn't see it. But anyway, they went into hiding. And this is an interesting story because there was a friend of his that hid him in the attic, just like Anne Frank's folks were hidden in an attic. And the problem was that they had me and my brother. And it was kind of hard. I was 2.5 and my brother was 5.5. It was kind of hard to keep me quiet. Nothing has changed. It's still hard to keep me quiet. But anyway, as a small child, they had to do something because if the Germans came in and found them, then the people who were hiding them would be sent to Auschwitz as well. So what they had to do is they had to find a place for my brother and I so that we wouldn't be with the parents when they were caught, if they were caught. And so they made an arrangement. The Bundt family was the people that hit us, and they made an arrangement with the Dutch underground, and they found a 17-year-old girl that was able to take me on a train and smuggle me through the German lines. And this girl risked her life for, if she'd have been caught, she'd have been sent right to Auschwitz with me. And so it was a big undertaking. And the biggest problem was they had a fake passport because Jews didn't have passport in Holland. So the Dutch underground created a fake passport, but it wasn't very good. And so everybody was concerned about if they really studied it, they would see that, you know, it just would not be real. And so what they did is they put a person in front of us to keep the guy busy when he was checking passports, asking him questions and so forth, with the hopes that he wouldn't be able to check the passport. Well, that was successful. The guy kept the guy busy. The whistle blew, and the officer had to get off the train. So we got to the orphanage, and there were supposed to be people to pick us up. It was about a two or three mile walk. But the only guy that showed up was a person on a bike. And so he took the luggage, and Olga Krumling, who was the girl that smuggled me through the line, she carried me on her back. And as I got in touch with her after the war, she wrote me a beautiful letter. And I said to her, she said, "You know, Arnold, it's amazing how out of all the things that happened, the thing I remembered most is you kept slipping off my back. And you said, Tante, which is aunt, your back is very slippery." You know.
She and said, how old were you at the time?
2.5.
2.5.
So they finally got me to the orphanage where I was there. And through another route, my brother was also put in there. And we stayed there. And then, of course, one time my brother had to be moved by the Dutch underground because he knew he was Jewish and the Germans would come through and they thought he was a cute kid. They gave him rides on tank and everybody was worried that he might mention that he was Jewish, which would have given away the whole orphanage operation. Mm-hmm. So in the meantime, the big thing with my mom is that the way they were going to do it is they didn't have a phone there. So somebody down the street, the orphanage was going to call them and tell them we arrived safely, and then my folks would know. And it took about an hour for the train. So after 2 or 3 hours, nobody had called her, and she was getting very, very nervous. It really upset her to think that something might have gone wrong, you know, because mm-hmm. the train ride was about an hour. So anyway, my dad kept on trying to persuade her, "No, we can't go down the street and use a phone because the Germans are all over us. We don't have a passport, and it's just certain death, you know." And so my dad says, "Look, Manya, if we go out in the street and we get caught, the kids will never have any parents." So my mom says, "I gotta know whether they made it or not. I don't care about anything else." Anyway, after about 4 or 5 hours, he said he couldn't contain her anymore. And she said, "You go, if you don't go with me, I'm going by myself." And so my dad says, "What could I do? I had a very bad feeling. It was obvious what was going to happen, but mm-hmm. you couldn't stop her." And I said, "Pa, how could you let her do this?" He says, "Have you ever argued with your mother?" And I said, "I know what you mean. She's a very powerful woman." But anyway, they went out to a butcher shop that had a phone. And the people in the butcher shop were Nazi sympathizers, so they called the Gestapo, and they arrested my folks. And what's really interesting when you study this is here you have the same people, the same religion. One was willing to risk their life and their family to save people. And here's another people that turned Jews into a death camp for a food rations and 15 guldens. And so it just shows you the difference, how important the philosophy was. And that bothered me for many years. What was the difference in people? But anyway, so my folks got caught and they were sent to Auschwitz. They were sent on a train ride for about 3 hours in sub-zero weather, horrible conditions, no food. There wasn't even any toilets in there. Women would have to go to the bathroom in a bucket. Somebody'd hold up a coat to hide them. And then the thing spilled over and it smelled and people died on the train. So by the time they got to Auschwitz, they really were in bad shape. Mm-hmm. Anyway, they had a selection. Both of them passed. And so then they were in Auschwitz for 15 months. And one of the interesting things that influenced my life a lot is there was a woman on the train who was a friend of my folks. She was a younger girl. I think she was only 23. My mom and dad were about 36. And she had a fight with her mother on the train. And so when they got there, her dad says, "Beppe, I have a very bad feeling about this place. I think you should apologize to your mother." Well, all these years, I thought she did. But it turns out I was talking to her son one day, and he says, "No, the thing that bothered mom all her life was she didn't apologize. She was a very strong woman." And so she said she went into the barracks and couldn't sleep. And there was a woman standing there and she said, "Let me ask you something. That big chimney with the black smoke, what is that?" They didn't know what was going on. And she goes, "Before I answer that, let me ask you a couple of questions." She says, "Sure." She says, "Do you have any children?" She said, "No." She goes, "Thank God." She said, "Did you come with your parents?" And she says, "Yes." She says, "Well, I hate to tell you this, but you're going to find out sooner or later. You might as well know that chimney is the crematorium, and older people, they gas the first day. So your parents are probably already gone." She said she went back to the barracks and just laid on the bed. She just couldn't believe it. And she says all her life, as she gave talks to young people, she taught them the principle how she wished she would have apologized. So I made that a cardinal rule in my life, that whenever I had a problem with a loved one, somebody I cared about, and we got into an argument, the first thing I do is apologize. And my daughter and my wife used to bet on how long it would take me to apologize if I blew up. And it got shorter and shorter. And I learned a very valuable lesson, is that if there's anger displayed in the argument, you should apologize anyway, because you're wrong, even if you're wrong, even if you're right in the principle, because when you lose control of yourself, you quit seeking for the truth and you're looking to defend yourself. You get your ego involved. So I make it a rule, even if I think I'm right, I go in and apologize, and that reduces the tension so you can sit there and discuss things. And that's made a big impact in my life. And I always teach that to any young person, because that's a very valuable lesson.
Yes, I would say so. Arnold, how do you ever even repay a 17-year-old girl that risked her life to save you?
I asked her, "What made you do that? Do you realize?" She says, "Oh, when they came and checked the passport," she says, "I felt like my heart was jumping out of my body." She says, "I was just so scared of what would happen, you know." And I said, "Well, what made you do that?" She says, "You know, that's the principle that my folks believed in. They were Christians, and they believed that it was their duty to save the Jewish people. And this man was a missionary, and he had his church. And the church was full of people who he was hiding in his home. He had other kids. And when I got older, I kept thinking about it. What made these people willing to risk their own life? I mean, I can't imagine sending my daughter on a suicide mission." Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's what it was. It was a suicide mission. And she said, you know, we really believed in what we were doing. And I felt that no matter what happened, I was serving God. This was the right thing to do. And she says, I feel very good about it. I said, well, I didn't know what to say to her. I said, you should. You know what I mean? It was incredible. And so that was the main thing. So we came to the United States, and we moved into an area near L.A.
And your parents survived, right? Your parents survived Auschwitz, and you were later reunited with them?
Yes, my parents both survived, but 39 members of our family died during the Holocaust one way or another.
I'm so sorry.
It was a total wipeout. The only people that survived is my folks and my older brother and I. Mm-hmm. And they were the only ones out of a very big family. My mom had eight kids. No, there was, nine kids in the family. I think she was the eighth. And they all were married and had children. It was horrible. And it took my mom at least 20 years to get past it. You know, I used to come home from high school all the time, and she'd be sitting there crying. So what's the matter, Mom? She'd have a picture of her brother or sister and a candle. But one day she said, you know what, Arnold? They're not going to come back. There's nothing I can do. I have to accept it. I'm moving on. She packed it up into a box, put it in the closet, never looked at it again. Mm-hmm. It was an amazing transformation once she did that. And she lived to be 98 years old. She was a very positive person, very good businesswoman. I could tell you stories about her that you hard to believe. She did business in Auschwitz. She bought off guards with diamonds and smuggled things and kept a lot of people alive, including this lady who was her friend. It was kind of, she was like an intern with her, you know. She helped her run the business in Auschwitz, and she recently died. She only died a few years ago. She lived to be 104.
Wow.
And she said, once you meet, she says, if somebody ever met your mom, I could guarantee them that they would never find a person like her in their whole life. She was just a unique individual. She was fearless. She believed in what she was doing. She was willing to take chances. And she taught me to take risks, calculate risk. I said, well, what do you mean? She says, well, in order to do business in Auschwitz, you have to have connections with the guard. But if you buy off the wrong guard, he could send you to the gas chamber.
Sure.
So I studied all the guards that we were involved in, and I decided that I had to pick one that possibly could be bought. So I picked a guy who was older, his shoes weren't shined. He wasn't interested in the whole Nazi philosophy. And the other thing I looked for, did he have some human quality? And so I finally found two candidates, and I studied him for 3 weeks, and then I made my move, and all my friends says, Manya, if you're wrong, you're going to the chamber. She said, let me tell you something. I figured this out. I asked everybody who was skin and bones when I got there, how long have you been there? I never met anybody that was here more than a year and a half. So I told all my friends, if we don't take a risk, you're going to die anyway, because you're going to die from starvation. Mm-hmm. Nobody lasts more than a year and a half. So we have to take the chance. She says, well, what if you get caught? She says, well, then that's over. But then it's going to be over anyway in a year and a half, and I have to struggle through all the weaknesses and all that. I don't need that. So she finally made the choice. And then the next thing she had to do was sell the girls when they had these big piles of precious metals and stones that they took from all the people. And there's guys standing there with a machine gun over your shoulder. You better not steal one, because they shoot you right on the spot. And she had to talk these girls into smuggling the diamonds out of there. So one of the girls, they said, Manya, what are you going to do with diamonds in Auschwitz? She says, that's my job. Get me the diamonds. I'll get you anything you want, medicine, food, whatever. Anyway, long story short, she finally found one girl to help her do it. So she finally had some diamonds. She picked the guard, and she went up to him, and she said to him, do you have a wife? And he says, yes. He says, does she like diamonds? And the guard smiled, and he says, have you ever met a woman who doesn't, you know? So she gave him the diamond. She didn't ask for anything. She said, I was just trying to make a friend. And so the guy came back the next day and he says, Manya, I can't tell you how happy my wife was with that diamond. It just changed her life. I'm just very appreciative. He says, I want to do something for you. She said, okay, well, I'd like, if you can get us some food and medicine, that would be very helpful. He said, tomorrow I will see you and I'll have something for you. Then she started getting referrals from his buddies. Said, hey, I heard you can get us some diamonds. She said, yes. So pretty soon she had a whole network going. And the most amazing thing is that she had a German guard smuggle food to my dad in a men's camp, which was quite a ways away. And my dad was sitting there after a hard day's work. And he said he was sitting there with a friend. And he saw a guard working towards him. And he told his friend, don't look now, but there's a guard heading towards us. And that was never good news. You're either going to... You're going to send to the chamber, send on another duty. So he just kept his head down. The guy goes up to him. He says, is your name Hugo? He said, yes. He said, what is your... So he said, I have a present from your wife. And my dad says he didn't know how to take it, whether it was a trick or, you know, whether it was somebody playing games with him. So he said, okay. So the guy opens up his briefcase, hands him some food. And my dad was just stunned. And he said, I need to know your Hebrew name. And so my dad told him it's Chaim. He said, would you mind telling me why you need my Hebrew name? He says, Manya doesn't pay us until we proof of delivery.
Oh, my goodness.
So that was her technique to know that it got delivered. And she was sending food and different things back and forth. And she ended up actually making a market in garlic, which everybody in East Europe appreciates because the Russians even use garlic as a penicillin. Huh. So anyway, that's how they all got liberated. My dad by by Patton's army, Third Army, and my mom was liberated by the Russians. And long story short, my mom got out 2 weeks before my dad. She went back to Holland, went to the Red Cross and looked to see if somebody, you know, what happens, people find each other, they register at the Red Cross and you can find your relatives. So my mom went there figuring there's got to be some relatives that survived. And the bottom line of it was there was nobody that signed their name. So my mom concluded that everybody was gone and she figured Hugo, her husband, was gone too. So she didn't bother putting her name in. So now, 2 weeks later, my dad goes there, looks for a name. There's no name there. So he concluded that everybody was gone. So he's walking down the street one day, and there was a milkman pushing a cart up a hill. He was an old man. So my dad thought, well, I'll go help him. So he's pushing the cart up, and they look at each other. It was his former milkman.
Yeah.
And Hugo, you and Manya are so fortunate to have survived this. And he says, no, my wife didn't make it. I looked at the Red Cross and her name wasn't there and nobody else's name was there either. And the guy says, well, she made it and she's alive. So my dad says, well, how do you know? He says, she's living with your friends up the street.
And that is incredible.
He was just stunned. It even chokes me up now to speak about it. Anyway, he said that the Americans had given him some money, so he went and bought some flour, knocked on the door.
Oh, my gosh. And wow. That was the nicest surprise in the world. Can you imagine being your mom and opening the door, your husband standing there? That is such an incredible story, and I appreciate you sharing it with our guest. I know in the past we've spoken so much about investing and philosophy and the right mindset and how Sir John Templeton believed in thought control. And you've shared some really interesting stories about that. And one of which it just sticks in my mind is about your father being on a death march and deciding to control his mind by just putting one foot in front of the other. Can you expand a little bit on that story and the difference in your father's perspective at that point?
You know, it just gives me chills on my right arm. Whenever I hear something profound or truth, I get chills on my right arm. And every time I tell that story, hear it, just like you just did, I just got it. But basically, we were talking about the Holocaust, and he was telling me about the death march. And the way he explained it is he said he was, I'm 160 pounds. And my dad was 85 pounds, and he was only 1 inch shorter than me. So he was half my body weight.
Oh, my goodness. That's
and
hard
he had
to imagine.
March 24 hours, no breaks, a slice of bread that was about twice the thickness of our normal bread. And the water, you had to scrape the snow off the guy in front of you and put the snow in your mouth to melt it. And that was your drink. And if you let your knee hit the snow and the snow was halfway up to your knee, you know, you weaken or you fall or something like that, they beat you. And he said the beatings were so bad that most people didn't even want to get up after the beating because, you know, they just couldn't take it anymore. And he says, and then they would shoot him. If they didn't get up, they'd shoot you. And he said, the other thing is, if you didn't keep up with the group, they also shot you. So he said, he asked himself, what's the most important thing I can do on this march? And he said, the most important thing is to keep his mind only focused on what he had to do. He couldn't think about how cold he was, how angry he was, how far he had to march. Nothing. Just put your foot down. And he said you had to make sure that it was planted well because it was slippery. It was snowing. And so he said he just locked his knee. And he said whenever a thought came in about anything else, he blocked it out. And he said, just move your leg. And he said, every time I moved my leg, I didn't think I'd be able to do it, but I was able to do it. And this went on for days. You know, they march you all night, and then you get on a train, and you go to another place, and it just went on and on. Some people were on it for weeks. Now, one guy was talking about a situation. He started off with 5,000 people, and they only ended up with 16.
Oh, my gosh.
So it was unbelievable mental pressure. So I said, Pa, how were you able to manage that? He said, you know, there's something about the mind that we don't understand. But when you focus it and you control it, he said, you can do many things that you never believed you could. He says, there's something about the mind that creates its own energy by focusing. And the way I explain it to people, to young people, is I say, have you ever had a magnifying glass and you compare it to the sun, you hand it up to the sun, you have a paper, it burns the paper, right? So what are you doing? You're focusing the sun. That's what happens when you focus your mind. It creates energy. Mm-hmm. And he said, and that stuck in my mind. I never forgot it. And I said, well, how would you explain it? He said, Arnold, I'm not a psychologist. You know, I don't know it, but I can tell you it works. It works. Yeah. So long story short, I was very weak after the war. I almost died from malnutrition. It wasn't that the people were trying to deprive us. There just wasn't any food and drinks, even water sometimes. But we came to America, and I wanted to overcome my physical disability. I was the skinniest, weakest kid in the school. And so I took up rope climbing. And I remembered what my dad had said, just focus on what you're trying to do. And I climbed for 2 years, and some kid never climbed before off the street and had to race, and he would beat me after 2 years of working hard, 2 hours a day. But I had this idea that there was something in the mind I was going to keep on it. And after that time, I thought about quitting, and then a thought popped in my mind, why would you quit? You're getting stronger. And I was getting stronger. Long story short, I ended up being a champion. I won the league 3 years in a row. I set the school record. I set the league record. And I placed ninth in the nation among all college seniors in the national AAU in 1958. And so
it
transformed my life. Mm-hmm. And I never quite understood it, but it worked. And I actually got to believing that I was going to be the champion. And there were people ahead of me, and And my buddies would say, how are you going to beat this guy? I said, I don't know, but I'm going to do it. I believe. What I've learned from the subconscious mind is the most important thing is it's not what you eat. It's not what you think. It's not what you do. It's what you believe. And what you believe focuses the subconscious mind and creates it. And I have some amazing stories to tell. I studied hypnosis. I coached my son in becoming a champion in his event. And we use the mental program. I hypnotize them every night during track meet. He says, I'm the only senior that the dad tucks him in at night. I'd have him put in bed and then I'd hypnotize him. Anyway, some great stories I had. He had a sprained ankle and there was a championship meet 9 days later. And so I went to the doctor and took him there and he said, oh, there's nothing we can do, Arnold. If the meet's in 9 days, there's no way. I'm going to have to put him into a cast. And I said, well, I can program the subconscious mind to adjust for the cast. He said, you don't understand. It's not the cast. It's even if he steps on the cast, if you got a sprained ankle, it still hurts. That's why people have to wear crutches. I said, I believe the subconscious mind can anesthetize his ankle and we're going to be able to compete. And he said, you know what? I'm not into that stuff. From here, I'll put him in a cast. We put him in a cast. We went to a hotel nearby. I hypnotized him and I kept him under hypnosis the whole meet. Long story short, he won the meet and he threw 6 inches off the best he'd ever thrown in his life. He was a shot putter. And so that was just an amazing testimony.
Yeah, that's so incredible. You know, John Templeton also believed in thought control. He often said to me, Lauren, when I encounter a negative thought, I just banish it to the nothingness that it is. And that was such an incredible thing to hear one of the world's greatest investors say. And, you know, he grew up in the time of Carnegie. He studied he was very involved in the Unity movement, which was all about thought control. I'm quite sure when you read Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill, it definitely reminds me so much of John Templeton, so much of you. So I'm curious, you make it to the United States. How did you transition to a career in investing? And how do you take all of these skills that you have developed, that you've learned from your parents, that you developed out of surviving the Holocaust, controlling your mind, how do you apply that when it comes to investing?
Well, what happened is I concentrated on my gymnastic career, but I had an image problem. And the image problem was when I started Hebrew school at a very young age, I failed the Hebrew school. It was like the kindergarten. So the rabbi and my dad got together and they tried to convince me that the reason I wasn't going with the other kids is because I was going to another class. But I knew that they were not telling me the truth. And so I started feeling very bad about not being able to do well in school. And when I got into grammar school and all that, nothing worked well. And my mom hired the best child psychologist you could find, and he convinced her, and that's what happened to me, is that he said that because of the malnutrition, it affected my mind, and I may have problems with that the rest of my life. And so I didn't realize that I did have the capacity, but I never bothered too much in the academic area because I never could do it, and I never did well. So I was able to get through high school barely. I was working in a gas station after I got out of high school. And so anyway, I was sitting there one day very depressed because I was a kind of a hero in high school. And now all of a sudden I'm working in a gas station. I'm saying, what am I going to do with my life? So the thing that depressed me is all the teachers told me, Arnold, if you don't improve your grades, you can't go to college and you can't be successful in life without going to college and you won't be able to make money. So my mom saw me sitting there one day and she said, Arnold, what's the matter? You know, and I said, Mom, I just don't know what I'm going to do with my life. You know, I'm through rope climbing, you know. And she said, what do you want to do? I said, I want to make some money. I'm making $1.15 in per hour, working 14 hours a day in a gas station, and I don't think there's much of a future in there. She says, and I said, all the teachers told me if I don't go to college, I can't be successful, and I'm not really equipped to go to college. I never did well. She says, what? The teachers tell you that you can't make money unless you go to college? She says, the first thing you should do is ask the teacher, what do you make? And when you find out what they make, you'll see that they don't know what they're doing. She says, now, here's the way it works. You're either a yekka or a businessman. I said, what's a yekka? She says, a yekka is a guy like your dad. He is smart, he's intelligent, he understands music, mathematics, politics, everything. Can he make money? Nothing. Nothing. He says, now, ask your mother. Does she know about psychology? Does she know about mathematics? Does she know music? Does she know anything? Does she care? No. Can she make money? Two thumbs up. She says, so, you need to listen to your mother, and she tells you to go out and start a business. I said, you know, Mom, what kind of business can I start? She says, what difference does it make? Business is simple. You buy something from somebody, you find somebody to sell it to, Manya's in the middle, and she makes the profit. That's business. And she says, you can parachute me anywhere in the world. I don't even care if I know the language. I can make money. When I came to Holland, I couldn't speak Dutch. We started the business on the dirt road street, and we built it by going out and selling. That's what you do. So that stuck in my mind, and so.
I don't even know your mother, but I believe her. I think she can make money anywhere.
Yeah, I think so too.
She could. I could tell you stories about her salesmanship that would just make you roar. But she believed it. She had a charisma. When you looked into her eyes, and here's another thing that's interesting about her. So she was in love with this, at 15 or 16, she was in love with this medical student, but her dad was a very religious person. And so the kid was Jewish, but he wasn't Jewish enough. So he says, Manya, as long as you live in this house, you cannot date this man because he's not religious enough. So she said, okay, Papa, if I can't live in this house, I'm not going to quit dating him, so I'm going to move out. Well, what do you do at 15 years old living in a small Polish ghetto, right? So she found some relatives in Germany. She wrote to them, and they said, sure, come on down. We have a business. You can work there. So she just took off, left the family. She said, we left on very good terms. She said, you know, I told my dad, Papa, I know that you believe this and I respect you, but I'm not going to quit. I'm not going to quit dating this guy. So I don't want to upset you. I'll just leave. So she left. She got on a train, got to Germany, and that's where she met my dad. So when she was telling me how she met my dad, I said, well, Mom, what happened to the kid you were in love with? She says, oh, when I got to Germany, I was so beautiful that all the men wanted to take me. I figured, who needs them?
That's a great story.
But you know what's interesting? While she's telling me this, I'm looking at a picture on the mantle when she was a young girl, and I thought, I'm not sure I would date that girl. Look that great to me. What's interesting is whenever people would meet my mom, the first thing they said about her, your mom is so beautiful. So even her belief in herself conveyed that to other people. And it's just some interesting story. But anyway, I got to working as an insurance company. And then the insurance company, I started off in a print shop. I became the supervisor. And then I was looking for more opportunities. I saw an ad by insurance company, be in your own business. So I figured I'd answer the ad. And it was about selling insurance. And I didn't know anything about finance or compound interest or anything. I thought it was a terrific deal. So I started selling. insurance. And then the insurance company, John Hancock Company, got into mutual funds. This is at the top of the bull market. And all the companies went into mutual funds. So when I started reading about the returns on the mutual funds at the top of the bull market, I was so excited. I thought, I finally found the business that I was looking at. I'm going to get all my friends into the mutual funds and I'm going to make them money. And I was just on fire. Well, the market lasted about 3 or 4 months, and then it started a sickening decline of 6 years while I was going through it. And all these funds there were some that literally fell apart. I mean, it was just amazing. But as I was going through and studying it, I was trying to figure out how come some funds did better than others. And I noticed when I went to the shareholders meeting, all of these guys seemed like geniuses. They were all brilliant. But some of them, their fund came apart. I can mention names, but I won't mention it. But some of them just fell apart, and others did very well. So thank God I was able to, dumb luck, spread that out over 15 to 20 funds. And so some of them did well, and some of them didn't do too well. But overall, the results were obviously very poor. So all this time, I'm going through the bear market. I keep dollar cost averaging, and things just kept going from bad to worse. And this went on for 6 years. I don't even know how I stayed with it. But I got very excited about a year and a half before the market, because I finally figured out that when I asked these guys who did well during the crash, I asked them, what was your philosophy? And they all pointed to Benjamin Graham. I mean, no matter who I talked to, all of the guys that did well were Benjamin Graham disciples, including Warren Buffett, one of them.
Sure.
So I thought, I got to study about Benjamin Graham. So I got all the books, I got all the articles, I read everything I could get my hands on, and I was totally dedicated, just like I was on the rope climb. There was nothing that I wouldn't do to improve. And so I read all the books and I read everything, and I finally got a feeling as the market was coming down, and just to, you can appreciate this, the market, the value line PE was 5.5 to 6 times earnings, with 7% yield with great balance sheets.
Yeah. When...
So I knew by studying Graham that we were in the cheapest stock prices since the Depression. Mm-hmm. So I told my wife, I said, you know, I said, we're either going to make a lot of money for our clients or the world's going to end. Because it was very bearish. I mean, I'd go to a social thing and tell people I was in the investment business, and they avoided me like I had bad breath, because everybody had been pummeled for 6 years in the market. And so, but about 3 months before the bottom, I finally realized if I was ever going to do it in business, this is the time to do it. So I got whatever people I could get, and I invested them in there. And of course, it was a long haul to, you know, I didn't have a background. I didn't have a track record. I didn't know any people with money. All the people I knew were just kids from school. But I thought, whatever I can, I'm going to start and I'm going to visualize it. I'm going to believe it. And by that time, I understood the subconscious mind. And the way I came about that is I was married and then I went through a divorce. And divorce was so painful for me. I went into a depression for 5 years, and it was very bad. And there was a woman at work at the insurance company that said she had gone through a similar thing, that I should go to her psychiatrist. So I was desperate. I wasn't getting anywhere, and things were very depressing. And so I went to him, and... I told him that I had been hypnotizing myself. I'd learned to hypnotize myself because at the end of the day at 3:30, I was so tired that I couldn't work. And it would be like it would be 3:30 in the morning. And so I read an article about hypnosis and the subconscious mind. And if you put yourself into a hypno nap for 20 or 30 minutes, equivalent to 3 hours sleep, after about a week, I was able to do it. And I was able to work until 10:30, 11 o'clock at night, and have a lot of energy. So that really fixed the problem of depression, But when I went to the psychiatrist, he says, you know, that's a very brilliant thing you did. He said, now, how would you like to find out why you're depressed? I said, oh, yeah, that would be great. He said, well, we'll start working on it. So I said, okay, the first thing I'd like to have you help me with is I've been plagued with this idea that the 17-year-old girl,
that saved your life.
Saved my life. And I couldn't understand how people could do that. And I really would like your advice on that. He says, oh, that's simple. I said, it's simple. I've been trying to figure it out for 20 years. He said, here's the key. If your principles are more important than your life, you sacrifice your life. If your life is more important than your principles, you sacrifice your principles. So he said, the people who saved your life obviously had high principles. The people who turned your folks in, their life was more important than their principles. They sacrificed the principles. There's no difference. It's just a decision. You have to develop a philosophy that you can live with that creates character and integrity so that no matter what you're faced with, you're not going to sacrifice your principles. He said, now, in the corporate world, people are working and they might have not strong principles, but they're decent people. All of a sudden, they get a chance to make some easy money. And if they don't have strong principles, they succumb to it and it ruins their life. Mm-hmm. So he said, my advice to you is you got a good start with your rope climbing career. Just keep on working on the character so that you have the principle, if you were faced that way, that you would make the right decision. And so that was a very pivotal point in my life. That changed my life right there. That example of this girl who fearlessly, at 17 years of age, and she told me after the war that this was what they believed. So I even got involved in studying the Christian religion because I couldn't understand why people would do that. And so I spent 3 years studying the Christian religion. And you know, the Jews and the Christians have been arguing about the Messiah for 2,000 years. So it became a real study, and I got involved with people who were Bible scholars who were willing to teach me the principles. And so one day I was sitting there and I thought, geez, all the stories I heard about Jesus, it didn't coincide with what his life really was. And I got to thinking, geez, everything he teaches sounds pretty good to me. Why would it be rejected by the Jewish people? So I was sitting there agonizing over it because I thought, God, what am I going to tell my folks if I have to say to them that I became a Christian, you know? And as I was thinking about that, a thought came to me, and that influenced everything I've done. It says, if you want to follow the truth, you have to go wherever it leads you. Mm. And I thought about that for a second, and I thought about it, and I said, you know, that's right. Why am I worried about who's right or wrong? Just follow the truth. And so that's what I've been doing. Even in my stock picking and everything else, the most important thing is to get to the point, what are the facts? What are the truth? And that guided me in everything, including raising my kids and all of these other things. So it all came together on the idea that it gets down to character. Everything gets down to character. And there's a book called Right as Might. And I saw the advertising of it one time, and the advertising was so good that I looked up the author and I thought he wrote 5 books. And so I called up the company. He had a company going, and I called up the company. I talked to his assistant, who was his assistant for 35 years. And I said, you know, that ad was so powerful. I ordered all 5 books. And so I ordered a book, and one time on a plane trip to L.A., I said, I'm not going to do anything else but read this book. So I got to finally I got to my destination, California, and I was so disappointed that the plane landed because I was so involved in the book. I grabbed my luggage, drove to the hotel, didn't even hang up my coats or my suits or anything. I just finished reading the book, and I finished it that night, and I was just amazed with what this man taught. So I called the company, and I got his assistant, And I said, you know, I just want to know more about this man because everything he teaches makes so much sense and it confirms everything I've learned about life. She said, oh, I worked with him for 35 years, but I'm the one that wrote the ad. I told her what was a brilliant ad. She says, there was nothing brilliant about it, Arnold. I just told the truth. Mm-hmm. I told the truth about what happens to people with character and people without it. And that's what his life was all about. And she says, I worked for him for 35 years. I'm 95 years old, and I'm the one that's promoting his book. He's already passed on, but that's my mission. And yeah. So I said, well, I thanked her very much for her time. I sat down and I thought, I got to read every one of these books. And I have them right there on the shelf. And the book is called Right is Might by Wetfield. And any young person who reads that would be influenced by that situation.
Oh, I love it. What is that the most is that the book that has influenced you most?
No, there's many books that influence me the most. I would say Think and Grow Rich would be right at the top.
Yeah, it's really good.
The first time I read that, it was in about 65, 66. And I said to myself, this sounds so fantastic that I only believed about 50% of the book. But today I believe 110%, especially when I got to studying the subconscious mind. And when the psychiatrist explained to me, when I told him what happened in the rope climb, he said, oh my God, that's amazing. He said, we teach sports psychology. Everything that you did is what we teach. Mm-hmm. And I said, he said, where did you learn that? I said, I just learned it by application and principle and trial and error. I didn't even know I had a subconscious mind, you know, but I visualized it and I believed it and it happened. And so he said, well, if you do the same thing in your business, Arnold, the same thing's going to happen. As soon as he said that, my right arm lit up. And I knew that he was speaking the truth. And just to give you an example of how fanatical I was, I met this girl who was just a fabulous girl, and we got along real great. And she said to me one day, why don't you come over Wednesday night, and I'll cook a dinner, and we'll hang out. And I said, oh, I can't. I've got a study, I got a study program. And she says, I didn't know you were going to school. And I said, no, I'm not. I've got my program. I've got all of Benjamin Graham's books lined up. And my goal is to get by this one through this one so I can start on this one. And I want to finish them all off by a certain date. And she says, well, what happens if you miss one day? I said, that delays that delays the day.
The next one.
She said, what are you studying to be, a monk?
No, reading is so important.
So anyway, but I was on the program, and the one thing I learned about my rope climbing program is I used to visualize climbing the rope and placing my hand. It's a real art. It developed into a real art. And I ended up climbing a 20-foot rope from a sitting position at 3.5 seconds. So you can imagine a rope hanging down in the gym 20 feet, and you start from a sitting position, you do it in 3.5 seconds. It's pretty amazing. But anyway, that's what the mind does. And so I made it a commitment that I would study the subconscious mind. I've done it for 50 years. I have 680 pages of notes and articles and things. And I have transcribed that. I think I sent you my first 55 pages.
I've got it right over here somewhere. Now,
I'll tell you, there is a world of truth in that. And not most of it is not me. There's only a couple of things that I actually wrote myself. These are all quoting people who've used it and how they used it and, you know, athletes. And I was able to hypnotize my son's buddies on the track team every Thursday night before the meet. I had every room in my house. I had a different track athlete in there, and I'd go from one room to the other to hypnotize them. And it just is amazing how well it worked. So the subconscious mind, you have a question in there that you ask, what would you advise young people? Boy, that's the first thing I do. And let me just tell you about the subconscious mind in just one quick article.
Yes.
They are talking now about creating a quantum computer. All my life, in 50 years, I've written and asked people, can you define the subconscious mind? How powerful is it? You always hear your mind is great. It can do anything. So I was in high school one day, and one of my teachers caught my interest, and she says, you know, you only use 10% of your mind. And I thought, maybe that's the reason I'm not doing so good. How do you use the other? So I couldn't wait to the end of class, and I said, could you tell me how I could use the other 90%? And she kind of paused, and she said, well, I guess it's by working hard. Well, I just knew that that wasn't the right answer. And so all this time I was thinking, and then my psychiatrist says, it's probably not even 10%, it's probably 2%. So the closest I ever got to calculating of the subconscious mind is that your conscious mind is about 50 bits of information per second, but mm-hmm. the conscious is 11 million per second. Yeah. So if you got a problem, you can see why you wouldn't get on a calculator when you have a mainframe between your brain, between your ears. But the good news is, in the last probably year, I ran across an article about quantum computing. And this quantum computer is going to revolutionize the whole, every industry is going to be affected by it. But what was fascinating to me about the quantum computer, it's going to be 158 million times faster than the fastest computer on the planet. And I thought, wow. So as I was reading the quantum physics, and I don't understand the math, I don't have the physics background, but I can read what they teach. And what they taught, and I have the article here, that the quantum computer can do 158 million times faster. And when they described this quantum computer, I said, everything on the subconscious mind tells me the same thing that quantum physics teaches. So I thought, my God. I said, I'll bet you that the subconscious mind is a quantum computer. So I searched all over Google, and I finally found a quantum physicist who's one of the leading in the field. I have the article right here. And he said that they believe that the subconscious is a quantum computer. So can you imagine you have something between your ears that is as powerful as a computer that hasn't even been built yet?
Unbelievable.
Yeah, and that's why it can do all these things. When you think about people, when you see the Olympics and you see these people skiing and they're doing flips and doing all these things, and all the time it's calculating everything and doing all the things in your body. I mean, you could never think your way through that. So that's what I learned through hypnosis. And, you know, the secret of that is, if you think about it, I have it right here.
Hey, Arnold, your life and everything you've shared with us today is so aligned with firm principles. I'm wondering if you could maybe share with our audience a little bit about the investment principles and how those apply to your methods as an investor.
Okay, let me get my thing out on investments. So here's the thing. I started Century Management 3 months before the bottom. And I had this visualization of creating an investment firm. But I had no education, I had no track record, and I didn't really have that much knowledge. But fortunately, we were at the bottom of the market, and I followed Benjamin Graham to the letter, and it really worked. For the first 10 years, I had a very good performance, even during the inflation. I learned a lot during the inflation. I outperformed the market by the first 10 years by 5%. And the reason I was able to do that, I was led to the idea that we were in an inflationary period. And I went to talk to my dad one time, and I said, what do you do during inflation? He says, look, the Americans don't know anything about inflation because they've never experienced it. If you want to learn about inflation, you got to go to Europe and talk to those people. They've been dealing it for years. My grandmother dealt with it. Mm-hmm. So I did. I saved up some money. I took a trip. And I talked to as many people as I could. And I came to the conclusion that gold was one of the answers. And so my first big hit in the investment field is I was very heavy into gold in the early 70s. And, you know, gold was at $45 and $50. It went to $800. Now, we sold out at 350 because I thought that was just, I didn't think it could go any higher. And that probably wasn't a bad time to sell, although it did go to 850 and then it came crashing down. But that's what led me into it. And the thing that is interesting today, what do you see about investments right now? I see very little opportunity in investments today. The market is overvalued in every measure you want to pick. However, like in all markets, there are opportunities. And today, I see investments in natural gas and oil and gas that is the cheapest I've seen in 50 years. I have five companies right here that are selling at less than 4x earnings, 2x cash flow, paying dividends, and have great balance sheets. Now, here's the interesting thing about the natural gas. There is an energy equivalent between oil and natural gas. Natural gas is about 6,000 MCF to a barrel of oil. When you boil that down, you basically take the price of oil, which I did. It's $77. You divide it by 6, which should be the price of natural gas, and you come to a natural gas price of $10.26. Now, it's $10.26, and usually it trades at about 80% of that BTU equivalent, okay? Today, natural gas at $2.50 is only 24% of the BTU equivalent, which means when I look back on the history, the cheapest natural gas ever got to oil was 24%, where it is today, and it's only been one time cheaper in 75 years, since 1945. So we have an opportunity to buy natural gas relative to oil. First of all, oil is cheap, and I can give you the reasons why. We're very heavily invested in oil and gas, but particularly in natural gas, because natural gas is even more cheaper relative to oil, and oil is cheap in itself. So we have one of the greatest investments since the 70s, in my opinion. People disagree with me, and I'm used to that. But the point is that if you look at the BTU equivalent, it usually sells at 80% of the price. Today, it's selling at 24% of the price. And if it just goes back to, you know, 80%, then, you know, you're at $10 gas, and it's at $2.50. So when you think about the leverage of a company that owns the natural gas and the acreage, and then that price goes up, once they pass their cost, $253 per MCF, it's all profit. And they're going to make huge amounts of money. So that's the first thing. The second
Arnold, how are you invested in the natural gas space?
We invest in natural gas companies that mm-hmm. produce natural gas. And I have four or five of them. Probably the leader of them, which is about $32 a share, is EQT. Let me give you the numbers. It's one-time book, 4.8x cash flow, 1.3 total debt to EBITDA, so they have a good balance sheet, 7.48x earnings, and the price, the price is 13.8 forward PE. The stock is $32.75, somewhere in there, and it's worth $70 or $80 once the price of natural gas goes. I have even smaller companies that sell. I have four or five of them right here. I don't know whether you want me to mention them or not.
Sure.
Okay. Well, I have Ovintiv is $9 billion market cap, 1.2x book, 2.49x cash flow, 0.88 total debt to EBITDA, 2.69x trailing earnings, 4.55x PE forward earnings, 37.18 closing price, and the stock could be easily $60 or $70 just with the burp up. But there's even better ones than that. But just to give you an example how cheap they are.
Yeah, now, exceptionally
here's
cheap.
One that's interesting. It's called Vital Energy, and the price is VTLE. And the stock is selling at about $48, and we believe it's worth close to $100. Let's call it 80, 90, just to be conservative. But let me give you the numbers. Now, here's what's interesting about this company. If somebody wanted to just invest in natural gas, this company is not an operating company. They buy in thousands of wells. So they go all over the country and they buy in the wells. Now, look what they're selling for. 1.11 times cash flow, total debt 0.74, forward PE 2.37, and it's close to $80 to $90. I mean, this company, you know, I haven't seen these multiples since 74. Remember I told you five times earnings? Every one of these companies is less than five times earnings with depressed prices.
And you see a long-term opportunity here because of underinvestment in the space, correct? Due to ESG and government policies and things of the last 10 years.
Well, there's a big problem with the government. We could be energy independent. We have, you know, 150 years of natural gas. We have 90 years of oil. The world is short of oil. The Saudis have tried to increase their capacity 1 to 2 million barrels a day. They've never been able to maintain it. They are almost at the end. They're rather lower the production and increase the price. Their budget is $90. So in order for Saudi Arabia to break even, they got to have $90 oil. That's why they cut production. They're not making any money unless it's $90, and they don't have any spare capacity. And the other part is all over the world, there's shortage of capacity to invest in oil. And the government, everything they do is against the producing oil. So what's going to make a change? Well, there's one thing I've learned. People change when they have to. You can talk to people about eating food and hunger, but if you're really hungry, you'll do anything. Look at Germany. They cut down their nuclear plants. They went totally green energy, you know, solar and wind. And now they're suffering so much because they're short of energy that they're actually chopping wood for heat. Yeah. Now, what do you think is going to happen when Germany, the majority of the population, are short? All the government regulations are going to change because they have to. Otherwise, they'll have a revolution there. And it's the same thing all over the world. So the world is totally short of energy. The renewable energy is only 10 to 15% of all the energy that's produced. They spent trillions of dollars over the last 12, 20 years. And, you know, they've reduced the energy from 86% to 82%. So all these trillions of dollars in 20 years, and they haven't reduced the dependency on oil. And you're not going to get rid of oil because it's in 6,000 products. And that's the reason we have inflation. And we're going to have more inflation as time goes on because of all of these insane government policies. Now, eventually, somebody else is going to get in office. Hopefully, we'll change that. But even if they don't, the pressure from people who are not starving, but freezing to death, is going to change that.
Yeah, so, well, it sounds like these are some incredible opportunities. But we started the podcast saying that you had some concerns when it comes to your grandkids, some things you're thinking about. What is concerning you today?
You know, I hate to even say this, but I'm going to.
Okay.
Everything that we saw happened in Germany is happening in this country. They're going against all the principles that this country was founded on. And I said to myself one time when my dad was telling me that, you know, the Jewish people in Germany were as highly thought of as professional Jewish people in this country. They were the doctors, the lawyers, the engineers, the professors, the, you know, everything. They were right at the top of society. And the Jewish people had lived in Germany for 400 years. They were more Germans sometimes than Germans because they were so dedicated to the German cause because they had such a great life there. Matter of fact, my dad was showing me a picture of his father, and I was shocked. I looked at him. I said, "Pa, this guy looks like a Kraut." And my dad says, "He was. He even fought for Germany in the First World War, and he was proud of it." Right. And then all of a sudden, this propaganda started and so on and so forth, and it changed the whole country. So my wife did a story, kind of made a video of my life, and she would interview my mom and dad more than I even interviewed them. And she said, "Pa, do you think this could happen in the United States?" He says, "Yes, it can." Because propaganda, if you believe in it, it can change a whole society. And we have to be careful that these violate the principles of the Constitution. The reason we came as an immigrant here is it was my dream to get my family in America because that was the golden land, right? So as you see these deterioration in the Constitution and the laws and executive orders, they are getting around the Constitution. And there's a lot of movements in here on the left that, you know, many Democrats don't even recognize their own party. I'm sure my dad was a Democrat, but if he was living today, he wouldn't be a Democrat. He'd be in some other country.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there's just some bad signs here. Now, hopefully that can be changed. But my wife and I watched a movie about the Iranian Revolution. And it was about a family who was a Jewish family who was very wealthy, and they were diamond dealers, and they were at the crust of society, and showed them with all their mansions and the way they lived and all of the things. And then all of a sudden, the revolution came. All of a sudden, they arrested him. They threw him in jail, and they went through all the tortures. And I finally said to my wife, "You know what? I don't want to finish this movie because it just brings back too many memories." Mm-hmm. And it was just horrible. But here was an Iranian country that at one time was very prosperous and very Western-like. And then the new government came in, and look at them now. And so this is the thing that we have a concern. Matter of fact, I had a meeting with a client yesterday, very wealthy people, very successful. And we were talking about this, and I said, "Let me ask you a question. If you had to move out of this country, where would you go?" Mm-hmm. The room got silent. Nobody could come up with another country. And so I said, "Well, if that means what you're telling me is you can't find another country, you better take care of this country." Mm-hmm. We have to convince people of the Templeton way. I mean, can you imagine if John Templeton was living today?
Yeah, I can't.
Saying about what was going on. Can you imagine creating laws as disincentives to come out with a mortgage and penalize people with good credit to subsidize people with poor credit? Mm-hmm. What are you going to produce? You're going to produce people who continue to develop poor credit because they're not going to worry about it. If you want to buy a home, you get a subsidy. Well, that's the wrong thinking. And our young people are scary.
Yeah. All these years of easy money that has created so much moral hazard in the system. And I almost wonder if we're too far down the slope to really do anything about it.
You know what? That's the good thing about America. That's the thing that keeps me the faith. We just finished a newsletter recently, and we ended it by saying, with all the problems, you know, America has certain things that no other country has. And I'll give you a good example. We got caught flat-footed in the Second World War. Mm-hmm. We weren't prepared for war. They even had some tanks that were from the First World War. That's how bad we were. But once America realized they got caught in Pearl Harbor and all the things that was happening with Germany, they started the Lend-Lease program. I gave a whole program on it, and I showed that when private companies got together and the government, and they all had the same goal to produce manufacturing goods and equipment for the war, they were able to do marvelous things. Just to give you an example, they figured out how to produce a battleship in 11 days, a complete battleship. They were producing tanks one a day. And so there is just an enormous manufacturing possibility here that if they harness all the ingenuity of America, we can outproduce anybody. And I'll tell you, the reason we won the Second World War is not because our soldiers were superior, but we threw equipment after them. We just drowned them in that equipment. Mm-hmm. And so Germany could not compete with us, even though they had 10-year head start, because we just outproduced them. But What I would like to see is somebody get a hold of this country and say, let's prepare for it, because you know it's going to happen. Look what China is doing. They are just drawing circles around us, and we're just sitting there. They sent the spy balloon up over all our nuclear facilities, and nobody did anything, and there was no penalty to China. I mean, it's just unthinkable. But if America gets pushed, they can do a lot, and so that's a capacity we still have. But it's not as good as it was in the 70s. Mm-hmm. In the 70s, our debt to equity was about 35% to 40%. Now it's 125%. The 70s inflation wasn't due to excess printing. It was due to the fact that the dollar collapsed. And most people don't realize it, that the real inflation doesn't come from just printing money. It comes when the dollar collapses and you have to pay more for everything. And the dollar collapsed at a level to such, it was got so low that I even wrote an article at the bottom of the 74 period, and I have the article right here. It's called Don't Sell the Dollar Short.
Can you hold it up? Okay. I'll have to check that out.
Yeah, now let me just show you what happened to the dollar after I wrote that article. That was in 79, and that was written right here. And look what happened to the dollar.
Hold it up a little higher. I see. It's okay.
So, look. Sorry about that.
That's okay. I see. Yeah. It's amazing.
So, look what happened to the dollar. Look how high it went. So we are right here, and what I did in the article, I took six items, and I compared them in different currencies, and it showed how cheap the dollar was. That's how why I wrote the article. Just to give you an example, the German mark was so high, and we invested in the Swiss franc in the 70s, but the German mark was so high that you paid $40,000 for a Mercedes. But the dollar Cadillac only cost $10,000. So you can see the relationship between, was the Mercedes really four times better, or was it because of the fact that the currency was changed?
Sure.
And so that's what I'm concerned about in the future here, that not only do we have all the earmarks of inflation, but we have the debt situation. And we have the books, and then you have the whole world trying to get away from the dollar.
Hey, Arnold, what do you recommend as the best way for investors to protect themselves in this environment going forward?
Well, the one thing I learned from the 70s, just to give you an example, an unweighted index of 21 commodities produced a 20.5% return. The S&P during the same time produced a 2.5% return. So when the dollar's going down and you've got inflation, the way you invest is you buy assets, you buy things, you don't buy equities. Now, we buy equities in oil companies, in gas companies. We own bullion, gold, 5% of gold. We own copper and almost every commodity that you could think of. But we don't believe in investing into the futures market. We either buy the company or we buy the outright. So I believe uranium, I believe nuclear energy is going to come back. So we are buying uranium and considering even more. That's another thing. And so basically, I'll give you an idea of a study I made to make it real simple. Let's say you divided the S&P by the commodity index, one that's been going back to 50. It's at 7.5 times, which means if I showed you a chart, it's almost right at the top. If you divide the commodity, if you divide the S&P by the commodity, it shows it's the lowest in 20 or 30 years. Mm-hmm. So obviously from a value standpoint, we're value investors. If you want to go where the value is in the commodities. Now, what I find by talking to other investment advisors, they say, you know, Arnie, I don't like commodity companies because they're the worst investment. They're absolutely right. but they are at the right time in the right place, one of the best investments. As a matter of fact, during the 70s, like I said, the commodities outperformed by 20% per year for 8 years. Mm-hmm. So we are in a commodity bull market, and it's going to continue to go. And the U.S. stock market is still overvalued. Matter of fact, I don't know what your favorite method of evaluating the market is, but let's just say you use market capitalization to GDP. If you took the Wilshire 5000, that's 5,000 stocks, divide them by the GDP, we are as high as we were in 2000 when we had a gigantic bubble. So the bubble has come down from 2 to 1.5, but if you look at a chart, it's right where it is. So, and you look at the commodity markets, they're the cheapest, the cost of production and everything. The reason is the commodities are so cheap is because we didn't invest in the commodity market.
Right.
You know, the S&P was so good. Why would anybody want a commodity company when you can have a growth company with no interest rates? But now it's changing. And now all of these companies, these commodity companies, they got butchered. And a lot of the oil companies went out because the shareholder wanted production in oil, production in copper, and they leveraged themselves and they kept doing it. And then it turned and they all got busted down. So not only did they not invest, but they're at cheap prices. And so some of these oil and gas companies, the smaller companies, I mean, they're trading as cheap as ever. Now, let's take a company like Pioneer Natural Resources, PXD. This thing is the single best big owner of the Permian Basin. They are paying a 12% dividend. And Exxon has, there's rumors that they talked together, they might think about an acquisition. Well, the stock's $225. There's no way this company is going to go out for less than $300, maybe $350. And at the same time, they've got a great, the best balance sheet in the industry, the best acreage, paying a 12% dividend.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what else do you need to know?
It's great. You know, well, you have described a lot of opportunities for investors as well as some concerns, and I certainly appreciate all the time you've spent with us today. I never get tired of your story, Arnold. I think it's such an inspirational story for everyone to hear, your life's journey, the passion you have for investing. And I keep this on my desk. It's a book that you gave me, Timeless Thoughts.
Oh, yes. Let me tell you something about that I discovered as the years went by. You know how they always tell you to listen to yourself, get quiet, and all the great truth and knowledge is in within ourselves. The one I discovered by following quotes is the reason people get attracted to quotes, it's the subconscious telling them. It's kind of like listening to that voice. So I have 5,000 quotes in my computer. And what I do is I file it by subject. So anytime I'm ready to study a subject, I have quotes by the greatest people who ever lived, their opinion of that. And I can't even begin to tell you when you read the Stoics and the ancient Greek and Roman philosophies, what they said about their society is exactly what's happening today. This, you just have to read that. But anyway, I have probably about 8,000 quotes now, but I keep on doing it. It's one of my hobbies, you know.
Well, this is amazing. Can listeners buy a copy of this? How would they find a copy of this?
I'd be happy to send it to them free. It's my gift to everybody. And so I purposely don't charge because it's not me. It's all the great people speaking to them. And so I don't want to make money off that. I want to give it as a gift. So anybody who wants a copy of it, I'm happy to send it to them, and it's my pleasure.
That's very generous. There are many in here I'm going to use with my kids. The only disability in life is a bad attitude. So I like that.
I know.
Arnold, thank you so much for your time today. Greatly appreciated, highly valued, and thank you again.
Well, nice meeting you. Good luck to you guys, and thank you for the opportunity to speak with you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for listening to Investing the Templeton Way. Please be sure to subscribe on your favorite podcast player. To view the show notes and resources mentioned in today's show, head to investingthetempletonway.com.